You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
They had a quick reaction fighter force, but it only worked during weekdays. So if the Russians came at the weekend, there's nobody there.
This is Cold War Conversations. Welcome to Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. Today's episode is brought to you by Osprey Publishing, and we're speaking with Michael Napier, the author of In Cold War Skies, NATO and Soviet Air Power 1949-89. Michael also flew the Tornado during the Cold War and served during the 1980s with 14 Squadron and 31 Squadron at RAF Bruggen in West Germany. He talks about nuclear QRA, low-level training in Germany, Canada, and Exercise Red Flag in the United States, plus lots more. His book is packed with first-hand accounts of operational flying during the Cold War, as well as stunning photos. I found it a really good read. For three lucky listeners, there will be a chance to win a free copy of In Cold War Skies. There'll be details in our show notes at the end of this episode. Now, if you want to support our work in preserving Cold War history, then for only about $3, £3 or €3 per month, you can help keep us on the air. Larger amounts are welcome too. Plus, you get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a monthly financial supporter, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If a financial contribution is not your cup of tea, then you can still help us by leaving written reviews wherever you listen to us, as well as sharing us on social media. It really helps us get new guests on the show. So, back to today's episode. I'm delighted to welcome Michael Napier to our Cold War conversation. I've really enjoyed the book, but also it's really interesting to have somebody on the podcast who's a first-hand eyewitness of the Cold War.
Yeah. One of the reasons I suppose I came to write the book was I realised is that the Cold War had been part of my life for, well, the first 30 years of it, really, both as a child and then, as an adult, and taking part in the final sort of 5 years worth in the front line in Germany in the RAF.
Yeah, and one of the things I wanted to just quickly talk about was some aspects of your RAF career. You were very kind to send me through some detail, and you were at Bruggen in 85, I think, with the Tornado, weren't you?
That's right. Yeah, I finished my flying training in midway through 85, and I was posted out to RAF Bruggen in Germany, where there were at that stage 2.5 Tornado squadrons, the half being 14 squadron, which I joined 14 brackets designate and brackets squadron, which was literally just forming with the Tornado, and then we took over from 14 Jaguar squadron in November. And yeah, so I was right there almost from the beginning of the Tornado at Bruggen, and we were straight into the Cold War at its height, pretty much. The first thing that we had to do was to qualify for nuclear operations so that we could stand QRA, because at that stage there were always QRA, well, nuclear armed jets ready to go at 15 minutes readiness. So that was the sort of priority for the station. And then once we'd done that, we then progressed on to qualify for attack combat ready. And in that, the wing was very much involved in a thing called Option Alpha, which was the a counter-air plan, whereby when the balloon went up, we'd all go charging across the border and take out the various Soviet and East German airfields, and also the SAM-5 sites, which were, the SAM-5 was a massive threat to things like AWACS and fueling aircraft and all the rest of it. So our job on day one of the war was to go off and take them out and take out particularly the MiG-29 and other such bases over in East Germany.
You make it sound so easy.
Well, yeah, we didn't have to do it. I think it probably would have been more easier said than done, as they say.
No, it was interesting in the book because you talk about, well, in fact, you feature in the book because you're one of the eyewitnesses that are slotted in throughout the narrative, which I thought was really, really good because that did bring it to life.
Yeah, I kind of cheated a bit and used my own bit there. Something we're very lucky that the whole of Germany was a low-flying area. It was full of targets, both the army, various armies deployed around the missile sites, the Hawk missile sites were around, and the skies were full of other airplanes, either fighters or other ground attack aircraft. So, yeah, it was one big hoolie. We used to go off to Sardinia twice a year for our armament practice camp, go and drop lots of bombs and then do air combat on the air combat maneuvering instrumentation ACMI range. And then we go out to Goose Bay in Canada, where we could be hooligans and fly around at 100 feet. Well, Germany was mainly at 500 feet with 250-foot areas, but you could fly down to 100, which is what we would do for war. So we qualified out in Canada. You know, the cherry on top of it all was if you could get out to exercise Red Flag out in Nevada, and that's what I managed to do right at the end of that first tour, was to go out there. And that was just absolutely fantastic in that the Americans had... Well, rediscovered, because I think the Germans first found it in World War One, and then found it again in World War Two, and the Americans found it in Korea, and then found it again in Vietnam. That basically most of the combat losses were in the first 10 missions that people did while they were kind of learning the ropes. And if you survived those 10, you were likely to be able to carry on and do your complete tour. So the idea was with Red Flag was that they had this massively realistic training environment where you would fly your first 10 combat missions. And thus, hopefully, make yourself a bit more survivable in the case of real war. And they got this. I mean, it was a fantastic setup. They were realistic targets. When I say realistic, life-size replicas of airfields, huge, great life-size replicas of factories and God knows what else out there, real armed personnel carriers and convoys and things. And it was defended by a mixture of genuine Soviet air defense kit with cameras on it, so instead of shooting you with a missile, they shoot with a camera, and also the aggressor squadron who flew F-5s initially and later F-16s, and they flew very much to Soviet tactics, so you could train against those, and so you had this whole sort of integrated air defense system with realistic targets to fly against. So it was a fantastic experience, and then you know to cap it all, you lived in Las Vegas.
Wow. And so the Soviet equipment presumably was giving off the exact radar signature that you would have seen if you were attacking over East Germany.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think a lot of it has been acquired by Israelis and other such people. I mean, it was all a bit hush-hush as to how they got this stuff. But you're right. It was absolutely the real McCoy. The only difference really was that as opposed to flying over the plains of Northern Europe with pine trees and flat ground, we're flying over the desert with big sort of salt flats and then these huge great sort of 6,000 foot mountain ranges down the middle of it as well. So that was a little bit different, but yeah, the flying was just incredibly exciting and exhilarating. And, so it was great fun as well as being probably the best training that you could ever have anywhere short of actually going to war.
Yeah, because in the book, you mentioned that they actually recreate the layout of East German airfields like Jüterbog.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think the one that it was a Telitsche Peak airfield, I think, and it was actually it was Jüterbog, exactly. They'd obviously traced it out on a map and then put it onto the ground there and made another copy of it, a bit like sort of Disneyland goes to the Nevada Ranges, really.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was exactly right. I mean, the only problem actually from that perspective was that it was ploughed out of the desert. So when you looked at it from sort of 6,000 or 7,000 feet, it was an exact replica. Of course, we were coming in at 100 feet, and instead of any vertical extent, of course, we actually saw a hole in the ground, so you didn't really almost see it till the last minute. So, again, from that perspective, it was perhaps a little bit different for us, because, again, we were very much a low-level force. Our aim was to come in low beneath the radar cover, beneath the the engagement envelopes of the SAMs and things, and then drop our weapons, and then fire off it in Top Gear. Whereas the Americans had taken a different view, in that they would go in with, you know, wild weasels and electronic warfare, you know, basically to suppress the defences and then go in that way. And I think we tried to sort of use a bit of their, you know, use some help from them, so that they would take on the defences and we'd sneak in underneath while they went over the top.
Yeah, and with the nuclear QRA, do you know what targets that you were supposed to hit when the balloon went up?
Oh, yeah, you memorised it. You had it all. I mean, I knew exactly where it was. I can still find it on Google. I can still remember where the IP was. I can still remember the heading and distance. I had to learn all that. And we, you know, look at the photographs, and so I had a good idea of what it looked like. We had I mean, when you arrived on QRA to take over that particular aeroplane with its bomb, you knew exactly where you were going and what you're going to do when you got there. So it was all very, very, very well organised and very, very, very strictly, shall I say, regimented as well.
And presumably you had good intel, because I presume BRICSmiths were providing ground photos of the target as well.
Our targets were a bit further east than that.
Oh, were they? Oh, okay.
I can say no more.
Oh, okay. Okay. No, it's interesting. I was talking to a Vulcan navigator about a week or so ago, and he was telling me about the, you know, studying the routes in, and also the sort of discussion as to where you would go after the weapon had been dropped as well.
Well, that was the big thing, that nobody quite knew what would happen. You didn't know as you were scootling off at, I think we aimed to drop it somewhere at 540 knots, which gave you, I don't know, about 30 seconds or whatever. So that's what, 4.5 miles. So, what happens when it goes bang after that? What happens to the pressure wave on the aeroplane? What happens to the lift on the aeroplane? Then when the electromagnetic pulse hits, either probably just before that, actually, what does that do to the electronic flying controls on the aircraft? There were lots of massive unknowns about the whole thing, really.
Yeah, yeah, lots of what ifs.
Which happily we never got to find out.
But I guess they could simulate the electromagnetic pulse on the tech in some way, just to see what effect it might have.
One would hope so, but we, I mean, at our level, we had no idea. You know, we were given a job to do, and we said, yeah, we fixed how we'd do it. But yeah, in our minds, there were lots of you never quite knew, but and happily, we never had to find out either.
Yeah, and did you feel at the time that at any point it could kick off?
I think we felt. I mean, we did all the time. When I arrived there, we very much did feel that was the case, and there were no notice exercises, probably about two or three times a month. You know, 2 o'clock in the morning, you suddenly hear the hooters going, and we'd all race in, and yeah, you literally didn't know what it was, whether it was real or not. Obviously, the guys on QRA would come straight on, would be in the cockpit straight off. By the time we came in, we'd be arming the aircraft ready for option alpha to go off. And again, they were all pre-planned targets and routes and everything, so we knew what it all was. But you'd go through the whole, the whole rigmarole of getting ready, briefing for everything, and the engineers would be arming the aircraft up, and the exercise would stop when the aircraft were armed and we were ready to go.
Right.
And that was when we found out if it was for real or exercise.
It was probably about a year ago I spoke with a Phantom pilot who was on QRA, and he talked to me about the end of the Cold War, where he actually had some MiG-29s who'd come over for an air show actually parked on his, on his airfield. And he said it was just so strange. These guys who you were going to effectively kill if you were told to, was suddenly on the apron at his base and drinking beer in their mess.
Yeah, well, it was I had a similar experience myself, in that I was at Chivna in 1991, and the Czechoslovak Air Force sent some guys over for the air show there. I think they did a bit of a tour of the UK, so I think they sent one Fulcrum, I think, certainly one L-39 Albatross, which is a different story, and an Antonov Cub as their with the supplies and engineers on board. And yeah, it was quite weird seeing this thing sat there on the airfield. But yeah, the interesting bit was being in the bar at happy hour and having a beer. I think they brought over some proper Budweiser, not the American stuff, but the genuine sort of Czech stuff, Budweiser. And so we bottled of that and went over and Czech clears. there's only one guy who spoke English, who I think was the radio operator on the Cub. And I just remember sort of saying to him, click, you know, cheers, thanks for the beer, and saying, gosh, amazing, here we are having a beer. And, yeah, we could have been fighting each other, you know, 2 years ago. And he looked at me and he said, or worse, the effect of, we didn't need to worry about us, we'd have been on your side anyway, or something. I was not sure how, yeah, how much the Warsaw Pact would have held together if the balloon had gone up, so particularly in the last few years of it, I think.
Well, I think that's one of the question marks. And I think it's one of the interesting things I picked up in the book was that the Soviets, I think, kept the Hungarian Air Force quite small because they were somehow concerned about their reliability, I think you mentioned.
So, yeah, that was interested me as well, actually, that the Hungarians had been sort of equal partners during the early 1950s, and had got this air force being, and it was going to be built up. So I think they were due to get some. I can't remember the details exactly because having written the book a year or so ago, but I think they were going to get some tactical bombers. And then, of course, the 1956 uprising happened, and after that, everything changed. And yeah, you're right. They were never trusted again. And so the Hungarian Air Force, or, you know, Hungary is a big country, but the Air Force remained tiny and only had air defense aircraft. Yeah, they were no longer trusted after that. And yet the Czechs, who had also had their sort of big go in 1968, ended up, I think probably because they did have a very sort of hardline government, did end up being trusted with new kit, etc. So interesting.
Yeah, no, it was, and there's so many nuggets in there which I read and thought, God, I didn't know that. That's really interesting. But so I think it's a good opportunity for us to dive into the book a bit more. I mean, what was the genesis of the book? Why did you feel that this was needed?
Do you know what? The simile I only thought of this morning, actually, so that I bore you with, it's a bit like when you go to see Hadrian's Wall and you wander up there and you go, wow, this is amazing. And you look at the wall and you think, wow, how did they build that? That must have been what a structure. And then you look at the camp and think, wow, that's amazing. And then think, well, how do they organize it? How was a legion organized? And so it goes on. And for me, the Cold War, one of the things that really stuck in my experience of it was the structure of it, the structures, both physical and organizational. And as I mentioned, yeah, 30 years for a kid, I grew up, my dad was in the army, and so I was used to all the British Army, the Rhine, RAF Germany were there for 30 years. They were sort of looked like they'd be there forever. When I moved to Bruggen, and we got these huge great concrete bunkers and aircraft shelters which looked like they'd be there forever. And suddenly I think bunkers have been, well, RAF Germany and British Army, the Rhine don't exist anymore, as indeed, or, you know, most of the organisations at the time don't either, and a lot of those structures have gone now as well. And I wanted, you know, in that same way that when you pitch up to, you know, Hadrian's Wall and you look for the guide saying how it all worked, to produce that sort of almost one stop shop manual on, you know, this is the Cold War in the air and this is how it was organised. So that's where that came from, really.
Well, I think you've done that, and you've done that really well, because it's not just a list of numbers or a list of aircraft. It is written well, and it's a fascinating narrative for anybody who's interested in the Cold War, whether, you know, aviation is their speciality or not. Now, what I was interested to know is how you thought of splitting up the chapters, because you've sort of split them into different time periods, and this is always a challenge, is sort of like when one era finishes and another era starts. Could you just, you know, take me through how you came to those?
Yeah, I kind of cheated in that I thought, well, if I take the date of the start of the Cold War, one can argue whether that was the Berlin airlift or something else, but I said, well, let's make it the beginning of NATO, or formation of NATO. So that puts this in 1949. When did it end? Well, let's just say it ended when the Berlin Wall fell, which is 1989. So, you know, you've got 40 years, and actually you've got four decades there. So that was really how I divided it up. And I'd done a book on the history of the RAF earlier. And the thing that struck me as I sort of looked at history is that I think it's quite important that things which happened at the same time are described at the same time, because they invariably impact on each other.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Libsyn Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
So there's no point in saying, right, this is the Americans from the start to finish. This is the, you know. And so what I thought I'd do was to look in each sort of bracket of time and then describe all the things that happened in that time. So chapter-wise, I've divided up into the decades, because that's, yeah, I suppose it's cheating really, isn't it? But it does happen to work quite well in the way things changed. And then within that, I've then looked at the various areas. And I've kind of gone twice round. So we've looked at the first 5 years, and then looked at the second 5 years, and then into the next decade, and do a similar exercise. But I think that way, things that are contemporaneous, if you like, actually are described together, so you can see how they affected each other as they did.
And I think that works well, because whilst you don't want to go into detail about the political aspects, obviously they impact on the narrative anyway, and you cover that in a good summarized way that makes you realize, you know, what period you're talking about there.
Yeah, because I just wanted to put things in context, because military things do happen in a political context. I think it's quite important to have that, the background there, the structure, so you can see how it fits together. So, yeah, the idea was just to sort of give you just enough so that you can see why the various military sort of things happened.
Yeah. And in the 49 to 59 chapter, which is called A Peace That Is No Peace, very cryptic.
Yeah, that's a quote from old 1984 man, George Orwell.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay.
Well, if you look at all the chapters, they're all...
I got the We Will Bury You, because I knew that was Khrushchev. Yeah. And I hadn't realised. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Freezing Frontiers is who?
That's Willy Brandt, I think.
Oh, okay.
I can read, because if I just find the...
I should have researched far better, Mike. No. I've let myself down.
Yeah, so Willy Brandt said, the Cold War with its sterile paradox of freezing frontiers without eliminating the risk of conflict did not point the way to a solution. So that's where the freezing frontiers come.
Okay.
And the tear down this wall, you'll recall the speech by...
Ronald Reagan.
Reagan.
We have that in our intro to the podcast, actually.
Actually, I did see that. Yes, you're right. And they did the same thing with the neutrals as well. We've kind of met. Yeah, there's a little quote from a politician at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll come on to the neutrals in a bit. So I wanted to cover that first decade, the 49-59, which was interesting with the RAF still flying Spitfires, albeit vastly modernized from the Battle of Britain version. I was really surprised at, but by the end of the decade, they're flying the Hunter and the Vampire, and the speed of technology moves very quickly.
Well, it does. You're right. I mean, and it wasn't just, I mean, it's the Soviet Air Force was flying Spitfires as well. And I was surprised to find that the Portuguese Air Force was flying Hurricanes. So all these sort of bizarre things that you discover. But you're right. I mean, when you look at where technology went in that 10 years, if you think the beginning of it was Mosquitoes and Spitfires and similar things, and then the far end of it, you're looking at your MiG-21s and your Super Sabres and Thunder Chiefs and all the rest of it. It's an incredible step up. And also, in terms of the strategic bombers, I mean, the Russians had nothing to start with, and by the end of it, they were flying around in Bears, which were so good that they're still flying around now in them. So it was really a massive, massive increase and step up in capability and technology.
Yeah, and this was also the period where NATO was carrying out quite a number of overflights for intelligence gathering, wasn't it?
Well, that's right, because although, I mean, again, the Soviet Union was still finding its way, really, in terms of building itself an air defence system, and it being an absolutely massive country, and still, although it did have a massive air force, it was a very inexperienced one and a thinly spread one. So there was great opportunity to go scooting over the top of it and be able to take as many photographs as you liked. And particularly when the U-2 came in service at the end of the 50s, they were able to do exactly that. But one of the things the interesting story I found was when the RAF borrowed American RB-45s to do some reconnaissance. So I think the Americans decided they didn't want to do it for some political reason, but needed someone to do it. And the RAF said, well, we'll do it for you. And off they went. two different sort of this Operation Jiu-Jitsu, as it's called, where I think one in 53 and one had been a couple of years earlier than that. And again, I think on the last one, they were actually intercepted and shot at, but managed to get home.
Yeah.
But yes, there are lots of sort of clandestine, sneaky-beaky stuff going on, American RB 47s and people getting shot, were getting shot down as well.
Yeah, because that I think you've got a number of those in the second decade, the 60 to 69, We Will Bury You. There's like an RB 47, I think, shot down over the Kola Peninsula.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And there was, I think, one in the 50s actually, which that was one that shot down. Another one in the 50s that was attacked, but didn't actually get shot down. It managed to escape. So I think that story's in there. I can't remember which chapter that one's in, but yeah. And there was another one, I think, in the 60s, an RB 66, which got shot down over East Germany, having taken a wrong turning.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. 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 No. And obviously, again, the technology moves forward there. So the surface-to-air missile is improved because obviously Gary Powers was brought down by tech that the Americans didn't realize could get to that altitude.
Yeah, and that was interesting because also the Americans didn't realize that the Russian radar could work that high because they knew that it was based on one of their own designs from World War II. What they hadn't worked out was that the Russians had actually managed to sort of modify it and change it, and make it better. So they thought, well, if we go over at 60,000 feet, they won't see us, but they did.
Right. And presumably there's also a change in the organization and tactics because with ballistic missiles becoming available, the strategic bomber loses some importance.
It does, yeah. You're right. But also I think that the tactical air forces lost some of their importance as well. We famously know about the Duncan Sandys Defence Review in 1957, which said, right, it'll be missiles from now on. And I think a lot of people at the time thought, yes, that's the case. I mean, the Soviet frontal aviation ended up, I think, being almost halved in numbers in the early 1960s. Because they felt they didn't need it anymore, because they were going to use tactical artillery to give them air cover and missiles to as tactical air defence. So the whole sort of shift, if you like, in terms of aircraft did change quite dramatically at that time. And then there was the great resurgence when people realised that missiles didn't actually fill all those gaps, that you did need aircraft and you did need manned aircraft as well. Again, that's one of the interesting things about the Cold War is that at the end of it, when we all came to fight in the Middle East, that how much could be read across, and how ready we were to fight the wrong war, as it were. And I wonder if and again, this is another reason why I was quite keen to write the book to make sure we don't lose sight of what we once had in terms of structure and organisation to fight that kind of war, which, who knows, we might be called upon to do again. And I think that if saying, oh, that's never going to happen again, history tells us it's probably not the thing to do, really, because things tend to come round full circle, as it were. And again, which I think is quite important to realise how things were organised back in the bad old days of the Cold War.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And this pair is also the V-Force.
Yeah.
Appears, which is obviously everyone's favourite, the Vulcan.
Yeah, yes. Although I have to say, I have more and more, as the more I think about it, I have more and more difficulty with that, because the Vulcan obviously famously had the Blue Steel missile, but as did the Victor. And in fact, it was the Victor that outlasted the Vulcan in the end. Admittedly, it spent most of its time as an air-to-air refueling tanker, whereas the Vulcan spent only its last sort of few months doing that. But even when you look at the raid on the Falklands in 1982, when you look to put one Vulcan over the top of the Falklands, the number of victors that were involved in that mission. So, in many ways, I think perhaps the Victor should be remembered as being the V bomber really made a difference to the world. That's, I understand, probably not a very popular or sexy thing to say, but there you go. Yeah.
Sounds like a book in the making there, Mike. But the blue steel missile is an interesting one because this was a standoff weapon, which didn't last that long, did it? It was phased out in 68, I think.
Well, it was, yeah. Basically, when we bought Polaris, Polaris, and in fairness, was probably an awful lot more effective. yeah, so when Polaris submarines came in, the Navy took over the duty of the nuclear deterrent, and that was the end of Blue Steel. And again, I mean, Blue Steel had been, because that had come in, so it was going to be Skybolt in the 50s, that got cancelled. Then, and again, we ended up with the intermediate range missiles as well for a while. So, yes, Blue Streak sort of came in the mid 60s and then had it stay fairly quickly and was dispatched back into the back into the history books.
Yeah, yeah. I enjoyed the story in this chapter around the two Luftwaffe fighters who strayed over the GDR and had to decide that Berlin was the safest place to go to.
Yeah, that's right, because they suddenly realised they couldn't turn around. So basically they had to then just keep going as fast as they could eastwards, so they got to Berlin. And of course, when they landed there, the Germans were banned from having any military equipment in Berlin. So they'd, you know, not only had they strayed across the border and upset people that way, they'd then cause this massive embarrassment by arriving where they weren't allowed to be. But yeah, there's always little sort of little tidbits here and there, aren't there, which are quite amusing.
Yeah, and these are the stories I love discovering in this book, because I don't pretend to know everything, but there was lots of stuff in here I thought, God, I don't know about that. That would make a really good episode for the podcast.
Yeah, well, actually, that's the thing I found out when I was researching it. There's always little bits that came up, and you think, oh, that's really interesting. Didn't know that. Yeah, so there were lots of little bits here and there, which were fascinating, and even little bits like the Polish getting their nuclear weapons from the Russians, and the fact they had to build this storage area which had to be secret, all these weapons were moved into Poland without anybody knowing. Yeah, various little stories here and there, and it's all those little bits that are interesting, actually, aren't they? Sort of, as you say, fascinating little bits.
Absolutely. So if we move into the 70-79 decade, the Freezing Frontiers chapter, this is an interesting one here, because there's new technology, and some of the new technology is quite different. I mean, what I'm thinking of is like the rise of the assault helicopter.
Yes, that's right. And that's something I've kind of largely because I'm sort of interested in airplanes as opposed to helicopters, it's only mentioned, but it is, you're right. I mean, that they discovered really, or the Soviets particularly, thought, well, this is actually a better way to go than having fast jet airplanes sort of whistling over the battlefield. Wouldn't it be better to have a huge, great helicopter that, can go relatively slowly, soak up the the punishment and deal it out as well, and also cart troops around. Basically, it was an airborne tank, and yeah, that technology, as you say, is quite amazing. And I'm amazed that we were so slow to pick up on it. I mean, I suppose to an extent now, aircraft like Apache sort of go some way to that. But even so, there's the ability to carry your own troops or stuff like that. But yeah, you're right. It is interesting that the Soviets went that way and did so well, really, so effectively.
Yeah, yeah. And also there's some learnings from the Arab-Israeli War, the Yom Kippur 1973 war, aren't there?
Well, there were, yeah. I mean, the 67 war was the interesting one from the perspective right at the beginning of the decade, in that the fantastic operation on day one that the Israelis ran, which took out basically the whole of the Egyptian air force, was well learnt, and airfields were toned down, hardened aircraft shelters that I mentioned right at the beginning were built, and people aircraft were camouflaged. But yeah, 73 came along, and well, to an extent it emphasised, I think, the lessons that the Americans were already learning in Vietnam about electronic warfare. And they're developing the tactics of wild weasels, SEAD operations. And I think that was, again, it really came home to after the Yom Kippur War, quite how effective, or the fact that you really did have to have all this kit in the present day and age if you were going to fight effectively against, fighters and SAMs and stuff that was, particularly firing missiles that required radar locks and infrared locks. So yeah, right. That really did change, I think, in the 70s.
Yeah, and on the sort of RAF side, if you've got aircraft like the Harrier, the Phantom, and the Buccaneer as well, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. In sort of back end of the 70s, the Air Force suddenly invested a lot of money, should I say, in these airplanes, which gave it really a quantum leap in capability. You know, the squadrons had been flashing around in Hunters from the sort of mid-50s, suddenly had a Harrier. So you've got this amazing ability to... to fire off into, you know, fields and farmyards and hide your aircraft. So again, you know, referring back to the sort of lessons of the 67 war, you know, dispersal, you know, you could actually hide these things away and actually keep them fairly close to the battlefield and just pop out and send them over the battlefield and then land them again and nobody be able to find them. Then you had aircraft like the Phantom, which in terms of capability initially as a ground attack aircraft, but you know, with an inertial nav system, able to carry a whole lot of kit. It actually had the radar, apart from having an air to air mode, had a good air to ground mode and a terrain avoidance mode apparently as well. So it could actually at a push sort of fly along in poor weather at low level to find targets. But particularly as an air defence aircraft, massively superior to the Lightning that it took over from, and the Buccaneer, again an airplane that could go an awfully long way at very low level and carry a lot of ordnance, so and drop it accurately as well. So you know, from the days of flying around the Canberra at 300 knots, you know, looking out the window to the Buccaneer flashing around at 500 knots and going further and carrying more, was a real massive step up in capability.
Yeah, and the Buccaneer wasn't originally built for the RAF, was it? It was for the Navy.
No, it was a naval aircraft. Yeah. And well, the RAF really only got it by mistake. Well, I say mistake, but originally it was supposed to be the TSR-2. Then it was going to be the F-111K. And then when that got cancelled, suddenly the Air Force needed a long range interdictor, and that's where Buccaneer came in because it was such a good aeroplane. Yeah, but through default, it appeared did a great job as well.
Yeah, and the RAF are also using the Jaguar, which is quite an interesting aircraft because it's not, well, it's isn't it a multinational project?
Well, it's French, yeah. It was, there were three projects in the 60s. There was a supersonic airliner, which we all know, Concorde. There was a... strike interdictor aircraft, which was the Anglo-French variable geometry aircraft, which through various other sort of morphings eventually became Tornado, and the other one was a Anglo-French military training airplane, which was Jaguar. And I think they realized when it came out that it was a particularly I think it's quite a difficult airplane to fly, so it's a particularly bad airplane as a trainer, but actually it was very effective as a ground attack aircraft, or strike attack aircraft. It was used in the nuclear strike role in Germany by the RAF, and it had for its time, cutting edge technology in terms of navigation.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Equipment, navigation computer, inertial nav system tied in with a weapon aiming system and head-up displays. So, you know, it offered amazing accuracy, and being quite a small airplane as well, it was a tiny target for fighters to find. So, yeah, it had 10 years from 75, I think, when it first joined frontline RAF Germany, through to 85, when it eventually was phased out and replaced by the Tornado, as a very, very effective ground attack aircraft.
Yeah, yeah. And what's happening on the Warsaw Pact side as far as their movements ahead in aircraft?
Yeah, well, the MiG-21 goes through various changes and becomes souped up and better and better. So the sort of later versions had very advanced radars, and again, it was a small and very manoeuvrable airplane. So it really was the sort of original sort of jet air superiority fighter, really. So that carries on. Then we get the MiG-23 coming in, which, again, a variable geometry airplane. I think quite a difficult airplane to fly, I gather, but again, a very capable one in terms of what it could do and the fact that it was a swing roll airplane that you could use it for ground attack as well. The MiG-25 had already come in to sort of in the late, very, very late 60s. But again, so we've got the MiG-25 as this massively sort of high performance, high speed airplane that was there to, you know, to take out high flyers and fast aircraft. Although the airplane that I found one of the most interesting is Blinder, the Tupolev Blinder, which is this long-range fighter that was used up in the Arctic, could go off for miles and miles out into the over the Arctic Ocean. Again, I found that whole sort of side of the air defence up in that Arctic region fascinating, really. Whereas the Americans had, and Canadians had gone for this business of having a sort of defensive line. Originally, it was the Pine Tree Line and the Mid-Canada Line, and then the distant early warning, the Dew Line. I guess largely because of the size of the landmass and the the size of the country. And the coastline, the Soviets had gone for sort of picking areas, you know, the important areas, strategically important areas, and defending those, mainly with missiles, but then also having this outer screen of long-range fighters. And again, operating from these places right out in the middle of nowhere. There's a place that's actually out on Graham Bell Island, which is, if you look on the map, it's right up massively far north. It was built on the ice, and guys would deploy there for periods of time. And another airfield in Novaya Zemlya, which is again right up not quite as far as north as Graham Bell Island, but these places right out in the middle of nowhere, and they're sticking fighters out there, which must have been horrendous for the crews, but there we go.
And I think that again, this is one of the strengths of the book, is there are these pieces of history which haven't been ignored, but haven't been really covered more. And I found myself when I was reading the book making quite a lot of notes saying, oh, I should have a look, I should be looking up that, and I should be looking up this. And I think what I found unusual was the level of detail you had on the Warsaw Pact deployments as well.
Yeah, it's a matter of a reading around. There's quite a lot of stuff out there. I've got books, and again, through the web, you can find quite a lot of stuff. Although, I always make sure that stuff is double checked and triple checked if it comes from a website. But again, it can get you into documents and things and books. There's quite a lot of stuff on the CIA website, bizarrely, which where you can read American intelligence reports and things. And I think there are a couple of websites that I think I put at the back of the book that point you towards bits of information. But what I was trying to do, really, I think, was to produce this kind of one-stop shop where you can look at it, find details, and then if things interest you, then fire off yourself and look into them. But
well, it definitely does, and I think that the section that probably underlines that the most is the section you have on the neutral or non-aligned nations, which I found absolutely fascinating. Yugoslavia and Albania and countries that would not normally get covered.
Those are two very interesting ones, but I found the Swedes and the Finns to be absolutely fascinating, actually, the way they organize themselves. And at one stage, the Finnish Air Force, something like a third or fourth largest in the world, which seems unbelievable, really. But again, the way that they organized the sort of integrated system that they eventually got around to doing. I mean, in the sort of early 60s, even, I think there was, they had a quick reaction fighter force, but it only worked during weekdays. So if the Russians came at the weekend, there's nobody there. It was a bit strange, isn't it? But that's how they worked it. And again, the Finns, who were kind of forced into having to sort of toe the line to an extent, but who nevertheless kept their independence. A couple of one of the interesting things was on the Swedish bit was managing to track down a Swedish Viggen pilot who'd intercepted an SR-71. Which was it's an interesting story, because he was on QRA on a dark and murky morning when they were suddenly launched and told to fire off towards this target. Well, they weren't told what it was, and it's only when they got there they discovered it was an SR-71, which actually lost an engine and was therefore down at level they could find. But I think it's quite a shock, as he said, to turn up and see this thing there. So we look at the other one that really fascinated me was the Austrian Air Force. When you look at that, because that ended up severely limited, really, both by budgets and by neutrality, and the aircraft never really were up to the job that they were supposed to do?
Well, it's almost like they didn't bother. They just thought, oh, we need to have a few aircraft to look like we've got an air force, but we're never going to be able to protect our airspace.
That's right, yes. And then when they couldn't in in 68, then suddenly all the guys in charge all got sort of shouted at and sacked. so that was interesting. Then you get the countries like Albania who was in the Warsaw Pact and opted out, and Spain that was out of the of NATO and then opted in. There's quite a few sort of changes here and there, and it's interesting to try and sort of put all those together and again try and pull the thread together of how they're all organized. That's a difficult one, actually. There's the Swiss, because you suddenly realize that actually they keep things quite close to their chest, really. But again, that was interesting. How have the great Mirage scandal, where they bought by these Mirages and then said, oh, can we have this and can we have that? And then when the bill came, it was a case of, oh dear, we haven't got that much money.
I'm with you with Sweden. I do find their story during the Cold War quite fascinating, because they were, you know, for a country the size of Sweden, they had a strong aviation industry and were building some really good aircraft.
That's right, yes.
But also their army. I mean, they developed that tank, the S-tank, which I know is moving away from aviation, but, you know, no turret.
Yeah.
But apparently when the British Army tested it, they said, actually, this isn't bad, and we're seriously considering buying them.
That's right, yes, because no turret. So it had a very low profile, didn't it? So,
Yeah.
That's right. I think that was the thing that the Swedish brought to all these. And then again, look at their aircraft as well, is that sort of thinking out of the box. You know, they'd come up with some very really interesting solutions and very ingenious solutions as well. So you're right. I mean, and produced their own airplane. So yeah, particularly interesting little air force.
I was interested with Sweden as well, because the quote you used was "hold the border," which I think their defense minister came out with, and this was around that Soviet submarine grounded itself.
Yeah, that's right.
And it looked at one point as though the Soviets were sending a flotilla into Swedish waters to rescue the sub, and he put that order out, hold the border, and if these ships had crossed the line, they were going to fight.
Yeah, that's right. And but again, that referring back to earlier on, that the Swedish had always had a very, very credible deterrence, or were a credible force such that people wouldn't want to mix with them. And I think that you're absolutely right. And the Russians even thought twice. Because again, I hadn't realised till I started doing research that aircraft like the Lansen, that was actually mainly used as an anti-shipping aircraft. You know, a couple of wings of these things were designed because the Swedes were worried that there was going to be this amphibious force was going to cross the Baltic, and so this was their way of they were going to take out the Soviet amphibious forces as it came across.
I mean, there is so much to cover in this book, Mike. I really enjoyed it, and I keep digging into it as well and looking at sections. And you have managed to collect a huge amount of data in the book, and the photos are stunning. Some of the photos are just I've never seen before, and you certainly picked the right one for the front cover.
Yeah, I can't take credit for that. I must admit it was that was the team at Osprey said this, we're having this one. So I went, okay, that's good. you're right. It is quite a breathtaking photograph, that, isn't it?
It really hits the button. Yeah. But as far as the data is concerned, I mean, you've also got in there the air order of battles for Europe for 55, 65, 75, and 85, I think, in the appendices.
Yeah, I have to say, that's probably the bit that I'm most proud of, really, because that's, I managed to sort of find my way through all those things. I thought, halfway through each decade, as I split things up, let's see who had what where. It would be a massively thick book if it had everybody's stuff on it. So, obviously the continental state, the USA stuff isn't there, and the sort of mainland Russia isn't there, but I'm aware that I've missed out the RAF bit of it. Except for RAF Germany, but those are mentioned in the text. But the rest of it, I think, is pretty much everything that was around in that sort of strip of continental Europe from either side of the inner German border, and what they had and which units they were. Because again, I think that's quite important, is to know which units were there, because those were it's a number. I'm looking at a page here, Jabog 33 at Buchel. Well, but those were those are real human beings who actually would the, you know, ground crew, air crew, and all the rest of it, you know, and who probably still have a sense of belonging to the, to those units, just as I have a sense of, you know, still belonging to the squadrons that I was on in the Air Force. So for me, it was quite important to actually to record all this, really, and again, put it in some sort of perspective.
And that again adds to the value of the book, I think. One of the things that really touched me was where you mentioned about the air crews that had lost their lives during the Cold War, because a lot of people obviously think of the Cold War as not being a shooting war particularly. Yeah. Okay, there were proxy wars and there was Vietnam and other areas, but the number of air crew and also other service people who lost their lives on exercises must have been in, well, I'm not even sure what number it would be. And earlier on in the interview, you did talk about, you know, planes being difficult to fly. And one of the ones that you always hear about was the F-104 and how difficult that was to fly. But I think people forget about those, or, you know, you and I don't. That is a sort of very much forgotten part of the Cold War. And I've really struggled to find a number as to what that level of casualty might be.
Well, I think you're probably talking thousands. I mean, you know, if you look over those 40 years, I mean, even when I was in the Air Force in the sort of in that period of the 80s, I think we were losing, I think probably about one fast jet airplane would crash every month, and probably about half of those were fatal. So you're losing six guys a year. And if you then translate that across all the years and all the air forces and you know, scale it up or down, depending on the size of those air forces, and particularly if you go back into the 1950s when there were all these massive air forces with lots of probably quite poorly trained pilots flying quite poorly built airplanes, the rate, I mean, I know the RAF attrition rate was massive. But you can put it across to what it must have been on MiG-15s and all the rest of it. I mean, I know, for example, I think one of the examples that I quoted in the book was the MiG-19, I think it was, in Bulgaria, and how they had a 48% attrition rate. You know, I mean, that's phenomenal. You know, and I don't think the MiG-19 was a particularly good airplane, but you're right. I mean, a lot of guys. A lot of guys did meet sticky ends, and that carried on right up to the end of the war. And for me, it is personal, because I lost some very good friends myself, actually. And again, that's another kind of reason why I'm determined that shouldn't be, they shouldn't be forgotten. That what they were doing shouldn't be forgotten, and what they stood for shouldn't be forgotten. So there's a bit of a personal bit there as well.
Well, I stand four square with you there, Mike, because that's really one of the purposes of the podcast, is to preserve these stories and to, record these stories firsthand, but just to make people aware of the sacrifices and what life was like during that period. Because obviously this was very much you were a young man joining the Air Force, and you left later on, and then flew for the airlines, but it was obviously a very important part of your life. But looking back now, what are your strongest memories about that period?
I think the strongest memories are almost what I've alluded to, of the massive sense of belonging to an organisation with a very fixed and obvious aim. Lucky enough at that stage, the defence budget to be such that, generally speaking, we had the equipment to do what we were asked to do. And the training and ability to do it, and it's a great feeling to feel that you're doing something worthwhile, and that you're supported in that by society as a whole. And I think which I think we did pretty much. It was a great feeling of doing something worthwhile with your life, with some great people.
Yeah. I think the other thing is around it being much more of a almost straightforward world. It was just the Soviets, or it was just there wasn't asymmetric warfare and all these other things going on.
You're right. I mean, it was, I think, a simpler world. It was a sort of a binary world, wasn't it? There was right, wrong, black, white, and that was it. And now things are much more sort of hazy and different and difficult to interpret. But yes, you're right. It was much more straightforward then. And I think it was a much more stable world as well. We might have been teetering on the brink of nuclear warfare, but because things were so well controlled and everything was almost kind of geometrically locked, so nothing could actually move in the end, whereas now everything's sort of free-falling and you're not quite sure which way the dice are going to fall, really.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mike, very much for speaking with us on the podcast. The book is In Cold War Skies, NATO and Soviet Air Power 1949-89. It's published by Osprey. It is like a coffee table book. It's a chunky tome, but well worth the value. Great photos, really well written. I really enjoyed it. I learned a huge amount from reading this book, and I've got ideas for a load of new episodes from this. So I recommend the book. It's available through any good bookseller, as they classically say. But we're also going to be doing a book giveaway courtesy of Osprey. We're going to have three copies to give away. So stay listening right through to the end, and we will tell you how you can apply to get in the draw and possibly win one of those. And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. And the show notes also contain details of the book giveaway, and you can also access the show notes at coldwarconversations.com/the word episode and the number 142. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Thanks again to all our financial supporters of the podcast, but a special thanks to our Politburo level Patreons, who are Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, and Jeffrey Jones, who are supporting us at $30 per month. Thank you. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.